listening to the AI in Motion podcast with JP Morgenthau.
Hey there, I'm JP Morgenthau, and I'm the host of AI in Motion, the podcast about everything AI in supply chain and manufacturing. And today, my guest is Brandon Wolf, who is co-founder and managing partner of Jordan Partners. Prior to forming Jordan, Brandon spent 6 years as an investor at Tiger Management in New York, focusing on investments in private companies. Before Tiger Management, Brandon was an investor at Jet Capital Investors and Cascabel Management. He began his career as a middle school math teacher via Teach for America program. And I'd like to thank you very much for joining us today, Brandon. So people may be asking, well, this is interesting. Why do you have a private equity investor on your show? Well, Brandon's company focuses on AI in service companies and the niche around supply chain management. And so I think it's a real interesting perspective that Brandon can bring about what's happening out there, what he's seeing out there from the perspective of acquiring companies. And so, Brandon, why don't you give us just a little bit of background about, well, how you moved from English teacher into private equity investor, and then from there, you know, what drew you to this particular industry or this niche within both, I would say, technology and supply chain management?
Sure. So thanks for having me. It's really great to be with you. Quick bio, because that'll lead to how we wound up here. I wanted to go to law school, and I did Teach for America before going to law school, but that was from 07, 09 when the great financial crisis erupted. I was from this little town in Appalachia. There was a paper mill on a main street, and that was it. And I'd never heard about anything in capital markets until 07, 09. And I was a math teacher getting ready to go to law school, watching all of this stuff unfold. I really take the view that if you love markets, they hit you the second you get experienced with them. And so I was in my early 20s and I just knew I wanted to be an investor. I didn't know what that entailed because I'm still this Appalachian middle school math teacher, right? But I figured I was going to make it happen.
Reminds me of that movie Happiness, In Pursuit of Happiness, I think it was, with Will Smith, about the guy who became a very wealthy trader slash investor on Wall Street. And he started off hot, very poor, and he walked up to a rich guy who's driving like a Ferrari or some expensive sports car and said, "What do you do for a living?" The guy told him, I'm a trader. He's like, "I want to do that." I think it's Chris funny, Robbins or something like that. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, I drive a Subaru, not a Ferrari by design, though, you know. So I think, like, in general, for me, it was more the intrinsic part. So, what I love about investing, that kind of ties to why I kind of chose this path. If you're a really curious person, but you're also really competitive, there's sort of nothing you can do that's better out there, right? So you study businesses all the time, you learn about things, you get to talk to experts like yourself about different industries. That feeds the curiosity gene. But I didn't really just want to be like an academic person. I didn't want to be a person who just like wrote PowerPoints and send them out. Like, I actually had to, you know, say, this is what I do and put points on the board. So that's really kind of what makes investing so fun. You're curious and you're competitive at the same time.
Cool. I like the combination, curious and competitive. Can you talk a little bit? I'm just, for myself now, I'm curious about your about this curious attribute, right? How does that fit into this, right? These two attributes, how do they fit in? I'm sorry, it's competitive, not curious. Curious makes complete sense. Competitive. Yeah. How does competitive fit into this? I'd love to hear more about that.
So at the end of the day, if you're an investor, it's all about performance. You can be a great person, you can be all the other attributes you want to be, but if you aren't generating a return for your partners, it's not a charity. People aren't going to stick with you, right? And what's also nice about it is that it's a field where it's very hard to BS people for very long. Like, you have to put points on the board. It's not quite as extreme as athletics, where you like win or lose and there's a whole crowd around you. But sometimes it feels like you're the person in the arena, you know, either getting cheers or having people throw tomatoes at you. Fortunately, more cheers than tomatoes is the goal. So, you know, there's at the end of the day, it's performance. Again, we really aspire to be great people, culturally down to earth, all of the above. But if people are backing us, they expect performance first and foremost.
That makes sense. Makes a lot of sense. I may be off here, But to me, private equity, and you know, I've been in a few startups in IT over the years. But in private equity, to me, has always, I mean, I'm a big fantasy sports guy. I like to play fantasy sports and DraftKings. Private equity has always had a little bit of air of that, of fantasy sports to me. It's like, you know about the players. You have knowledge. You have knowledge about the players. You know about the sport. You understand when two teams are playing each other, the benefit, pros and cons of each team relative to the way that, you know, to their, that competition, that game. But at the end of the day, as I like to remind people, NYAI will never, ever be able to predict the NFL, unless, of course, they listen to Julian and Edelman, and there is a script, the NFL script, right, that they walk in and give you. You'll be losing the game today. So, you know, if you don't buy into that, right, any given Sunday, right, your top guy can be injured, something can fall out, right? And so to me, there's always that air. You pick a company, you know about the industry. You know that they probably have a good niche. There's that piece that you really can't account for. It's the human piece, right? Yeah. The CEO has some baggage or hang up that you missed somehow, or just the culture is just off, or things turn on you. The market turns on you, right? So yeah. Tell me about how that fits into, you know, your whole cycle of selection, and then what do you do when you find out, you know, this wasn't what I thought it was?
Well, and I would even take that and go the other way too, which is sometimes investors find companies not to be what they wanted, but often companies find investors not to be what they wanted, right? You could take your framing and say, here comes an investor who now starts thinking short term, who starts putting more debt on the business than is required, who starts being just as fickle as the CEO you described. Maybe I'll describe what we do in our strategy, and I'll kind of explain how we try to reduce that.
Yeah, that latter part by my opinion, is just you were naive and foolish and don't understand how private equity works, right? But okay.
Yeah. No. So taking a step back, think about private companies. There's a few different ways you could have private equity, right? Because private equity is just equity in a private company. It's not a public stock or anything else. So one end is venture capital, which is where you're sort of trying to predict the next startup is going to be the next moonshot.
Excuse me, before you go too deep, for clarity, it typically, though, is an established company, not a seed round type environment. It's a going concern, right?
Yeah, so venture is more the seed and not a going concern. So that's not the specialty I have, but it is something that's relevant to your listeners potentially. Private equity, as you said, is more of a going concern. The company is probably cash flowing. It might have been around for 30, 50, 100 years, maybe five. It just depends on kind of where the company's at financial performance-wise. So you know, our firm, Jordan Partners, is the first institutional capital into growing bootstrap businesses. We focus on software and services that are B2B, and we focus on a couple of verticals, one of which is supply chain, that are very slow to change. So for one thing, we like the slow to change vertical because it just got to one of your points of the question, which is the market changes. We're not in markets where AI is flipping a switch and changing everything overnight. My joke is the internet is 30 years old and some of these sectors have still barely adopted the internet, right?
I mean, think about how many fax machines.
Yeah, exactly. EDI, right? Woo, like who even thought that'd still be around, you know? So I bring that to say that like that's one place we do to mitigate the risk. We're trying to play in places that have a lot of inertia where now you're betting on the financial performance and the team. So the team is another really important part. In private equity, and I can't just, you know, broad stroke everybody, but oftentimes I think the view is that the investor is the star of the show, when in reality, to use your fantasy football analogy, like, you know, the athletes are the operators. And so we are working very, very hard to invest with the best possible people we can. And the real training we have in that is our prior mentorship, where we were trained, my co-founder and I, either Tiger Management or a acolyte of Tiger Management. And Tiger Management was founded decades ago by this fellow named Julian Robertson, one of the best investors ever. I give him a ton of credit for having a way of diligencing people, especially management teams, that a lot of other folks will cut corners. Like in private equity, for instance, people will have like a consulting firm do the diligence for them, and they read the 200-page slide deck and they make a decision, right? With us, you know, we're really, really underwriting the people. We're digging in the dirt ourselves. So we would be really surprised if we got into a situation kind of like what you described. If you are in a situation like what we described, that is why, as a private equity investor, you often have some measure of controls, because you want to be in a position where if a person falls off the rails, the company doesn't go with them effectively. So I think that underwriting of people plus control plus hunting in markets where things are slow to change, like supply chain, is really a big part of mitigating that risk. I mean, again, there's a lot of luck in life, but as an investor, you're trying to do everything you can to minimize your potentially bad luck.
And because it's slow moving, do you have an extended wait time to recoup your investment or see it actually become profitable, or is it not necessarily?
No, the biggest drivers for our investment are revenue growth, margin expansion, and the ability to consolidate smaller companies into the company you own. And as a result of that, that's the kind of thing that in the right business can compound for 20, 30, 50, 100 years. What I love as a student of business is that you don't typically see really high growing companies do that for 20 years. But if you find a business in a large but fragmented market, and you've got a business that is not very big today, but they're compounding at 15, 20, 25, 30%, you can sustain that for many decades. And some of the richest people in America pursue that strategy. So as much as always,
I agree. I'm envious, right? The people who started a small widget business, and they just nobody knows who they are, nobody's ever heard of them, and they've just been growing it, right? And you find out the owner's got like three houses, one in Florida, one in Hawaii, three boats, a small jet, and you're like, you sell widgets, you sell these little nothing peelers, it's like, yeah. Exactly.
Right? You're probably sleep at night better than if you have the biggest tech companies in the world running at your business.
Right. So so because you're looking at supply chain, right? One of your interest areas is companies that are leveraging AI as part of improving this performance. So can you give a little insight to that? Is it that companies that are already in the portfolio that, and you're looking to add this to them or help them accelerate what they're doing? Or is it companies that already have an idea or are moving in that direction that you're looking at now? Is it, or a combination of both, I guess?
Yeah. So it's a combination of both. So we have one company in the portfolio that we can talk about in depth in a bit that is doing this really expertly. We're looking at a lot of other potential businesses we could back. I mean, one of the biggest themes we're pursuing are finding consulting businesses that serve supply chain clients that are developing some in-house software. AI is making it easier to write software. It's making it easier to provide value to your clients. The hard part increasingly is having those great clients. So if you have big enterprise clients, even if you're a consulting business, you can start to look a lot more software-like over time. So our two big themes are finding service businesses that are adopting other people's AI, or finding consulting businesses that are not just IT consultants anymore, but building some in-house software themselves. Those are the two really big things we're pursuing.
Where is your portfolio primarily lie, size-wise, the companies?
So every company has less than $10 million of EBITDA, and that revenue could be different. But the point is, you're talking about companies that are successful. I mean, like, almost no people in America have made a company with, zero to $10 million of EBITDA, but these are still relatively small companies with the potential to get much larger with some help from the right partner.
Got it. Okay. So we're not talking about companies that have spent money on established SAP implementations or big Oracle implementations. Technologically, what are you looking at when you find them? Where are they in the technology spectrum?
Yeah, at the high end, they might have just done an SAP implementation, but for the most part, you're kind of seeing Dynamics or something kind of that.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
I had somebody I've actually had on a couple of times now. That's what he does as a business. He implements Dynamics for a manufacturing company. So, and we've had a whole discussion about, like, what is the value? What point does the value of SAP, become important? Because it's so heavyweight, right? I can't imagine a $10 million company. They wouldn't get the value out of it, right? It's like a multinational type environment.
That's an interesting point, because one of the things we spent a fair amount of time on is NetSuite implementers. And NetSuite is sort of like between that, right? Because on the one hand, it's in theory mid-market and NetSuite. But on the other hand, it now sells Oracle products, since Oracle officially has owned it for X number of years now. So what is a Dynamics implementer, a NetSuite implementer? These are interesting themes to us. But again, it comes back to in a market like those, the right team with the right niche will always be able to find a way to get 3 to 5 to 8 times bigger if you find the right team in the right niche.
Okay. So these companies, though, the main thrust of their business is physical, correct?
Most of our stuff is services. Yeah. So we're going to be doing much more asset light type businesses. Now their clients are probably, you know, think retail, manufacturing, so forth on actual physical services.
So 3PLs, things like that?
Well, so 3PLs are an interesting one too. Yeah. So our first investment, it's called Sage Freight. It's a freight brokerage. You could call it a 3PL, but there's so much within 3PL that you can keep the asset light parts if you want to, right? So where they are today is purely in freight brokerage, which I'll unpack in a second and maybe share what they're up to. You can see transportation management. You can see other things that are asset light. You'll definitely not see them, you know, running like a FedEx or UPS competitor or anything like that for sure. So we really focus on asset light businesses that are kind of more knowledge worker in front of a desk doing software services.
So a lot of these businesses don't actually have distribution centers or physical real estate, warehouses, things like that, that they're managing.
Usually selling into clients that are providing that.
Their activities are, their clients are the ones with the physical assets.
Yep.
And then absolutely, they're adding a service or selling a service to those vendors or those customers that have those physical assets to add some value to that, right?
Absolutely.
But it's a software based, like a SaaS, or because I'm hearing that or I'm confused. It sounds like part of it is software, but there's also a component of it that might be human.
Yeah. So software, or think of it as professional services is the way to think of it.
Okay. So, so talk a little bit, if you can, about why AI is going to make a difference here. Why is AI all of a sudden now, you know, a benefit to these organizations? And do they understand it? Because, I mean, doesn't sound like at a 0 to 10. Maybe if they were born in the past 3 years, 4 years, maybe if they're older than 10 years, right? I mean, they probably have a ton of, they already have their software built. They're probably not looking at regenning the whole thing or rebuilding the whole thing again. So,
yeah. So the way we think about AI, there's pros and there's cons. Like, it's not going to be a silver bullet. So the pros are you can automate repeated tasks and you can synthesize a lot of information. Those are clear, solid pros. The negatives are hallucinations are real and they seem like they're sort of endemic in the product. Like, I don't know if in the near term we're going to not have those. So that kind of means a human has to stay in the loop. You can't fully automate all the time. And there are still big questions around privacy. I mean, I will watch businesses sometimes upload their data or other people's data into different LLMs where you kind of ask, did you just done that? So those are the pros and cons you got to work with. But then those pros, there are so many repeated tasks in supply chain. And when you just think about what the job is, there is clear opportunity here to streamline operations, to be more efficient. The automation of repeated tasks is going to be a big part here. There's still a lot of unknowns though. So what I would say is that alone is worth pursuing in supply chain, but what is still unclear is, to your point about all the different kind of tech debt that's out there, there's so much complexity in supply chain. It's what we love about the industry or the end market, but it's also why we don't think AI is going to be adopted in supply chain as fast as it is in maybe some other fields. So
and it's not the type of environment that is conducive to error dealing with errors.
Well, and that gets to the second piece, right, which is mission critical. So a supply chain cannot go down, right?
Sustain small errors very well either.
Yeah. And then I guess the second piece too, which is the pro and the con of supply chain itself is that it's a cost center. It's necessary, it's efficient, but you don't typically get a bonus for creating more ROI out of cost. And so that gets this other piece too, where there's still a lot of open questions around the cost of AI, right? It will get more efficient, it will get more productive, but at this point in time, it's cost prohibitive for most people to build their own stuff in-house. And then the question is, can you, with the help of a consultant or your in-house team, figure out how to make a good integration of the best off the shelf things you can. Some people can't. So we find it to be a really interesting space because we know there's going to be a lot of tasks that are automated, but mission critical complexity and cost are kind of the things that everybody still has to wrap their head around in supply chain. So what are those repeated tasks that we're seeing people automate really well? Fundamentally, reading invoices and bills and materials is just like we're seeing some really interesting things from consultants on that front. Call center negotiations and discussions. And we've seen some just incredible automation done off the shelf and by some bigger players themselves. Price bidding, transaction tracking, and ultimately training of teammates. So our first portfolio company in supply chain is this company called Sage Freight. They're a freight brokerage out of Brentwood, Tennessee. Just quick background what a freight brokerage is, simply for anyone who hasn't come across it. You know, in the US, you have tons of shippers and you have mostly independent truckers. There are some big truck companies that we've heard of, but the large enterprise shippers don't want to work just with the big truckers because they'll be squeezed on price. So you're a shipper trying to work with these thousands of independent truck drivers. How do you find each other? Like if you're sitting in a big consumer packaged goods company, you're not going to go talk to 10,000 potential carriers to haul your loads. So the brokerage model has been there for decades. It's a good business for both sides. And at Sage, to their credit, they're AI first with everything they do. And the first touch point for any contact is to go through their automation realms, whether it's call center, price bidding, training, anything else. If something is too difficult through automation, back to the point of being mission critical, you then send it over to an offshore team who is highly productive, highly excellent. If it's too complex for that team, you kick it to the onshore team. Candidly, I think this is what AI companies are going to look like in the future. You are going to see everything start in automated workloads, and when it gets too difficult, it's going to get in human hands as fast as necessary. And those human hands will still be enabled by automation and AI tools, but that's going to be the triage, I think, going forward.
That makes a lot of sense. Hang on, let's just take a quick break. We'll be right back. All right, I like to just, we're back in 3, 2, 1. All right, and we're back. And he envisions future of these service companies will look like from an AI perspective, but AI, anybody using AI in general, moving from a automate the easy to you know, become more of an added pair of hands, if you will, for the human. What I want to ask though, and this is where it gets interesting for me, because I do a lot of work with, you know, developing software very quickly, leveraging AI right now. And so I'm curious, the companies that your Sage Freights and out there are all selling to, you know, what is the likelihood that they could build this for themselves or might build this for themselves?
Yeah, so in the case of Sage, the good news is the shippers are going to outsource the brokerage to a broker. And if you're Sage, you're mostly just trying to stay ahead of other brokers. And there are some really large incumbents who are doing it well, but there's also some really large incumbents with a lot of tech debt. And it's also a market that's never going to be a winner take all. So I feel like Sage itself is pretty well insulated.
They have a moat. Their moat is that they have a network. They own
Better mousetrap, right? Like that would be their moat here for sure. So mousetrap built, purpose built for this new era, basically. So in the case of other companies, I mean, it's an interesting point. Like, why wouldn't people just do this in-house? And you have to have a huge budget to be able to do it. But even then, think about the kind of companies that are in supply chain. Most of them with huge budgets may or may not be the most innovative forces on the planet. So that's really what you're trying to deal with. I'm sure there will be some companies who have really large balance sheets and really innovative teams who will come up with something unique. But again, one of the key aspects of supply chain in general is that it's just such a fragmented industry. So you're not going to wind up having the killer app because you're going to always be a small piece of the market yourself.
Can you go a little more in depth on that? That's an interesting point.
Yeah. Well, so I'm thinking through this from a perspective, but I also don't want to like name company names.
Sure, that's like fine.
Right. Yeah. Companies. But like, so imagine a multinational supply chain company. It could, so many spaces it could be in, right? They certainly have the budget to go out and build this themselves in-house. The question is, do they have the political incentives among the top management to build it in-house? Normally people are protecting their earnings at that point. So they're gonna look for the most cost-effective way to do it. Do they have the internal team that's there to build it? The team that's been there for 10 or 20 years, isn't the team who joined because they wanted to build the next great iteration of technology. They joined because it's, you know, big balance sheet, secure, stable, maybe they like the work, things like that. And then lastly, I mean, this is, you know, you would always worry about a product that like Google could create and then just destroy you with, because Google has such large share in some markets, right? But if you had one multinational company create some really great version of in-house AI, that will take their market share from 4% to 6%. It won't take it from 4% to 80%. So, you know, if you're building any kind of business, especially one as small as the businesses we focus on, you always have to qualify your lead. You always have to know who your ideal customer profile is. And you would love to sell to large enterprises that are looking for a partner who can do better by being an outsourced specialist than being an in-house generalist, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I could see that. And I mean, I can imagine the companies too. We all, you know of the companies that have built or own their own supply chain, so to speak, right? I mean, they over the years have found it to be less expensive to them if they own all the things they used to buy. Right. Now they just buy the company that actually does that. McDonald's, right? You know, I own the roll company. I own the meat company. You know, it's like a potato company. I own the potato fields, right? You just start to spread out and start to say, you know, it's less expensive if I just own it, right? I own the entire supply chain, right?
Yeah.
So, but yeah, we're talking about a different audience. I mean, so Sage Freight is 10 million. They're servicing companies that are what size? Approximately,
they're largely with large enterprise companies, so think big consumer packaged goods, and they're also growing quite nicely in the mid-market. So mid-market is going to be more, less than 200 million in revenue, but a lot of their clients today have more than 200 million in revenue.
And so what else do you see going on out there with regard to supply chain and AI? Just, I mean, companies maybe you're not interested in acquiring, but I'm sure you speak to a lot of companies, you know, who are interested in maybe selling, or maybe they look interesting to you, but they're not exactly what you want. But you're just, the conversation you had, you must be drawing out a lot of data about what's happening out there, what people are thinking, and what people are building.
Sure. So I think I see two really big types of companies out there. There's either people who are trying to be the technology winners. These are the LLMs or the application software that's built around the LLMs. Sometimes it's infrastructure. You know, most of the infrastructure in AI is NVIDIA and other big public companies themselves. So kind of at the like foundational model layer or the application layer, there's just a lot there, especially in the application layer. That's much more of a venture game. It's not a place where we're focused. To me, it also feels like it might ultimately be a bloodbath.
It's very early in, and you're right. It's very risk, high risk.
Yeah, and the one thing I'll say for your listeners is that that part of the market gets the most press because it's the sexiest, it's the most exciting, and right. I would say have no fear of missing out, no FOMO about sitting on the sidelines if that's not the way you're wired. Because back to your point about the widget or the ball bearing entrepreneur, like that's not the game they played.
Boring, right? Boring is best.
Yeah, boring is beautiful. I'd go even a step further. Yeah. So over here, kind of away from the, you know, LLM or application software layer, there's the, okay, how can we make AI to have a better business? And by far, the thing that has been most interesting to us is finding across a lot of different verticals, warehouse management software, kind of generalist consulting, lots of different pieces. We've seen groups that used to be consultants and IT implementers who on a shoestring budget, much different than what the venture groups over here are doing, are building really good software that serves some use case. Maybe it's labor within WMS, maybe it's estimating tariffs over here for your general clients. Whatever it is, consultant and IT implementer developing in-house software, the in-house software is growing faster than the rest of the business. It's adding huge value to their clients. And that's great because you've already got clients who are mid-market or large enterprises, and now you can add more value to them. One thing I would say, you know, AI to us is not new per se. Obviously, what we're seeing is new, but there's been this long trend toward automation, and there's been a long trend toward technology getting easier and cheaper. It's the internet was part of it, and everything else is part of it too. So we really find that if you're a company that's already got great clients and you can more cheaply provide more value to them now, that's the most exciting part of the market for us. So finding consultants and IT implementers that are becoming more software-like, even if they don't become 80% software firms, they're building a better business by virtue of doing that, and they're serving their clients well.
And I agree, actually. I think that I've had some really great conversations of late, give you an example, about how, you know, everything's becoming an app. I think everything with AI will become an app.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, you could write a book per se, and then sell the book and it teaches people a framework. Or now you could just provide the app that contains the framework.
Yeah, right.
Right. I mean, and I just think it's getting to that point. I actually blogged about this where, you know, it's like the amazing thing I see about AI is that it allows me to take somebody, and I've done this now with somebody who is not a developer, and sit down with Claude and take their ideas and build an app.
Yeah.
Now, it is the ugliest app you ever want. I mean, and I mean that from both the infrastructure and operations perspective, not just, you know, the UI. Actually, the UI is beautiful. Claude does a great job building a UI, but it's a single page app, and nobody in their right mind could actually deliver that, you know, and get customers to pay for it because it's insecure. It's not scalable. It doesn't work, right? But what it contains is all their ideas, and what they need now is somebody who has understanding of how to build enterprise, you know, secure, robust SaaS apps to take that and turn their idea into something that fits that mold. And again, AI can do that very quickly. It's think about going from 2D to 3D. It's essentially, you know, a good analogy of what I've been seeing out there. So it sounds a little bit like that's what you see in some of your service companies, is you have these people who have great hands-on experience, have been putting together spreadsheets. Like I had a relative that who they were big in HVAC.
Mm-hmm.
They designed walk-in freezers as a big mm-hmm. part of their job. It's quite complex to get that right, especially when you're a food manufacturer, and, you know, you're not just selling meat in a grocery store, right? That freezer is part of the workflow. It comes off the line heated. It's got to go through into the chiller. The chiller has to work in a certain amount of time to get that ready to go to the next step in the food processing, right? Mm-hmm. And so he was also like programming. So he used to build these complex Excel spreadsheets. And of course, I'd get calls all the time. I can't get this. So how do I do this? Right. It's like, that's how I knew he was doing this work, was because I was his IT support.
Yeah.
But and today, I would say, you know, if he were still doing this, right, what AI would, you know, I'd say build the app. Let the app help you build the walk-in freezer and design the walk-in freezer. It sounds a little bit like kind of what you're seeing. Is that sound accurate?
Yeah, I think, you know, to build that app, he's going to trust an LLM, and you definitely want to make sure the privacy is good, you know, because the last thing you want is client data leaking into that and train the model. I mean, we all love it when you use one of the LLMs and they're like, I can give you a better answer if you give me PowerPoints, presentations. They're just like, no, I'm not here to train you. So what you described touches on another kind of debate that people have, and my mind isn't really made up either way. So you think about that Claude-based app and how ugly it is, but then you think about how most vertical market software itself is kind of pretty ugly, you know what I mean? So you have this dilemma of, okay, do I want to pay a lot of money for this very vertical specific software that doesn't have a great user interface, or would I pay even less to make a Claude app that, you know, is bespoke to me? That's why some folks have gotten somewhat bearish on vertical market software. I'm not really sure if I am. I mean, don't get me wrong, there's probably too many vertical market software companies out there. We don't need all these apps for, how many apps for hairdressers do you need, basically, right? But the flip side of that, though, is I don't have a dog in the fight. I don't have a strong view that like it's a yes or no, but we do think that AI is actually making a person in the loop more and more valuable. That's sort of the irony of AI, because as it gets easier to make the thing that is not human, again, back to my original point, because of hallucinations and privacy, it is becoming trickier and trickier to trust the thing that is not human. And so that person in the loop who's made more efficient by the app, as you described, but is also still the actual person testing hallucinations, that is making sure it's compliant in an appropriate way based on whatever, you know, each end market has different regulations. I think AI plus person equals the best model going forward, especially because we're in an environment too where pure software companies are quite expensive as an investor, and service companies are sort of neglected and not given enough attention. So that's why we're focused there.
So it seems to me that there's a lot of hidden knowledge that is ready to be harvested, right? That's the way I look at it, right? I know you're not a venture, you know, your organization, but it seems like you're positioned really well to have a venture partner or a venture arm, because you're running into people who have the knowledge. They are, you know, they're doing the service work, the professional services work on behalf of these supply chain large conglomerates. They know something. They have ideas in their head. Those ideas could become an application, right? How, you know, to me, I would view, I'd want to start harvesting that as well as, you know, investing in the other side. What do you think about that? I mean, where do you, you got to be sitting there, you're competitive, right? So you got to be sitting there going, oh man, that's a great idea. I'd love to, you know, do that, but that's not what I do.
Yeah, so I would say, I mean, the competitive point is the key thing. If you're competitive, the only way you win is by being focused. So we've got a very narrow box. We stay focused there. I've got plenty of friends who are VCs, and I'm happy to share any knowledge or give them. But the nature of VC is you lose money on a lot of investments, and a couple of investments make the fund back or more, right? It's called power law, where you have like 40 or 50% losers in theory.
It's doubling down at the blackjack table until you finally hit.
Whereas our investments are, first and foremost, don't lose money. Right. After that, try to make 3 to 5x in 3 to 5 years. Once in a while, make more than 5x over an appropriate amount of time. And that's really important because, as you said, we're back in going concerns, where the management team is often rolling with us, and you want to protect their capital just as much as ours. So my focus is right here, but I'm always happy to learn from VCs. I'm always happy to share. The one other thing I will say is you sort of touched on corporate VC, and a lot of these large organizations, the incentive is less about financial performance, and sometimes it's what's good for, insert your large multinational corporation. So I love talking to groups at big organizations like that, but you don't normally wind up investing with them. You just learn from them.
Makes sense. It would be hard for me not to hear all these great ideas and not want to act on them, right? That's just me, right? And so I guess I'd be better off on the venture side than the private equity side.
Well, it's funny. I think that's also a good operator, right? So it's funny. Like, I think there's some people are operators and investors, but the operator mindset is, how can it go right? And if it doesn't go right, we can always like retrade the deal in the future, right? Like, we can renegotiate the contract, we can fire the customer, we can do whatever. Let's give it a shot. The thing about investing, and this is true for you personally and any of your listeners personally, capital allocation is forever. Money that's lit on fire is gone for good. So in investing, you're really incentivized to sit on your hands and try to do things that are just right down your strike zone that you can understand. Because even then, there's still risk, but you're doing everything you can to fit that little focus box. So I don't know, I think it's, I was born contrarian and cynical, and I'm getting less judgmental as I get older. But I still have this ability to not worry about what people are doing. I think that's just
great. I mean, that for what you do, that's the right attitude, right? It's like, you know, yes, that looks pretty, but it's not in my lane. So I'm just, you know, maybe I'll tell a friend about it who isn't that does it. But there is an aspect of this, right? You're trying to grow these companies' revenue, right? Some of these ideas might be great ideas for improving their revenue. So I guess there's technology acquisition opportunities out of that.
Yeah. So, you know, any acquisition, the question is buy and build, right? And so if you acquire a piece of technology, you're either the sole client or they have other clients, but those other clients might be your competitors. So if you acquire a piece of technology, you might lose all the things you just bought. So I think if we were looking at technology acquisitions, it would almost be like, is it cheaper to do this than to do the R&D itself? But, you know, for a lot of our businesses, that's not been the focus.
All right. The big final question. Sure. Do you, because my answer, and I'm going to tell you my answer first.
Okay. I appreciate that.
My answer to this is heck yeah.
Okay.
Incredibly. Do you find it getting harder and harder to have a moat that, a protective moat around software products today?
So I don't have the affirmative heck yeah. I mean, I'll tell you that it's always been hard. Think about all the software companies that used to be here. They're big, they're powerful. They're no longer here. I think if you get people's data stuck and those people don't go out of business, you'll probably do okay in software. So don't sell to the supply chain startups because they might all go out of business. Don't just sell transactional workflows, sell actual data repositories and places where data are stuck. And that's how you can't replicate an ERP at this day and age like that. You know, that market's been won, but that's sort of what we're always looking for in terms of a moat in software. But you are right that if you don't get people's data stuck and you're not mission critical, your moat just shrinks because it gets easier and easier and easier. I agree with you 100% there.
So stickiness is the big win.
And I think a lot of people overestimate stickiness, right? Like they just look at the numbers and they say, oh, it's sticky. But it's like, well, yeah, but the customers haven't been in a recession. The customers haven't tried AI yet. You know, my favorite software business, when I can find it, in 2035, somebody's going to need to look to see what happened in 2018. They have to. It's compliance related. It's workflow related. It's whatever. Those to me are the best software businesses. And those are the ones that everybody kind of hates the most because nobody likes to be the ERP customer and nobody likes to depend on Excel, but that's what makes them good businesses.
True that. Yeah, I think that it's going to get really hard to dig into archive type stuff, right? And you can't keep it all live. I mean, yeah. I think right now we're trying. We're at zettabytes. You can't keep it all active, right? At some point you have to archive, compress, get it offline. And so, yeah, going back to 2018 in 2035 is going to be painful.
Right? Yeah, absolutely.
I've seen customers who tested their business continuity stuff and things like that, or going back for lawsuits and archival purposes and having to load tapes out of the safe, so to speak, right? In order to bring data back, right?
Yeah.
So it sounds like you like content management systems.
It's funny. Every company is a little bit different. You know, like I don't usually come totally top level like that. I like to actually look at what's happening with the underlying microeconomics and what customers say. Like my real North Star when I'm underwriting a company is what do the customers say? It's not what is, tech due diligence say, what does the management team say? It's what the customers say. If they love a product, if they require a product, if they couldn't live without a product, like that's, so whether it's content management, warehouse management, could be anything, as long as it kind of fits that profile.
But so just taking it a little bit further, the data is in a lot of the situations you're describing ends up very siloed.
Mm-hmm.
And the real value to the data is having it aggregated with other pieces of data in the business, right? So where do you see that business opportunity?
Well, and see, that's where we love having a consultant angle to the software side, right? So who is the person that can actually consolidate all that information for you? It's a trusted consultant or an implementer who's sort of the Switzerland, so to speak.
If they can find it. Right.
Fair. Yeah. So, I mean, when you think about supply chain, it's always going to be really balkanized and siloed, right? Like you're going to have on-prem and cloud and this and that. And, so that's always going to be here. You can try to be the killer app. We don't want to find the killer app. We want to find someone with the killer service and a really, really good app or a good suite of apps on top of it.
Is there, in your opinion, anybody out there that you've heard of or know of that has a census across the entire supply chain, able to see transparently across the entire supply chain?
Oh, yeah, there's nobody touches the whole thing. Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Keep in mind, I'm not saying cover all the silos. I'm just saying you're valuable if you cover multiple silos.
Right. I was just curious if you would, because I had never seen that, but to me, that would be something extremely valuable, right?
Well, I mean, the biggest part of supply chain, too, is there's just so many different teams on the customer side, too, right? Are we talking like manufacturing? Are we talking distribution? Are we talking procurement? Like, it's a big, vast ocean out there.
Yeah, I manufacture it. Back to our food analogy, right? An independent trucker is going to come pick it up and take it to a rural area because I'm not going to have my own trucks go to rural areas, right? So if I want to distribute my goods to some rural stores, I'm probably going to use an independent trucker, probably through Sage Freight, right? So now I've just lost control, so to speak. I probably, just like UPS, you know, scanned in, scanned out. I lose any insight of what happened throughout that trip.
Yeah.
I don't know if you kept your refrigerated truck at a good temperature, right? At the right temperature for my goods throughout the entire trip. I don't know if, you know, there was a malfunction at some point, you were unaware, right? So this, to me, there's an opportunity to like build sensors across the entire, like everybody should have, you know, I don't know, you tag the packages, I guess. It seems.
Well, I mean, that's one of those excellent use cases for AI, like the tracking in and of itself, with or without sensors. And the only downside of sensors is now you create more costs in the system because physical goods, even though they're very cheap, but you do a few billion or trillion of those and they start to add up. But no, I agree. I mean, tracking is only going to get better with AI.
Yeah, I was at the forefront of the RFID. And I was like, this is going to change the world. And it died on the vine, right? Because who can afford a smart shelf? Walmart. You know, it's like Publix can't, you know, Publix is wealthy. They still, I'm like, my margins, I'm not paying for a smart shelf.
Yeah.
I do love BJ's has this little guy, Telly, I think his name is. My kid loves seeing him in the store. He goes up and down the aisles doing inventory.
Okay.
I'm like, this is totally cool.
Oh, it's like a little, like, kind of one of those robots.
It's little robot, yeah. It's like, making sounds. And my son's like, I hear Deli. He's cute. He's made to look cute. And he just keeps going up and down aisles, taking, you know, manage. I'm like, that's smart, right?
But
that's a different approach. It's more visual, I think. Yeah. And it's emerged more recently than, but they've, you know, obviously that, why would I pay for RFID if I got a telly, right? Yeah. And it's probably not great. It's probably not perfect, but I can tell if there's a stock out condition on the floor.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, telly combines labor plus tracking, right? If you do RFID, you still have to have labor, and labor is going to be the biggest cost probably. So makes sense.
Really interesting stuff. I love this space. I do.
Yeah.
It's great. Listen, I really appreciate your time today. I really enjoyed having you as a guest. It was really informative. And thank you again for joining us.
I appreciate your time. Thanks for having me.
All right.